Well, we'll get started here. So, hi everybody.
Hi.
We're going to spend an hour together. I'll do a little bit of an opener, and then my wife will throw in from time to time as she has some inspirations. We like to banter in our talks. So, and then if you have questions as we go, please don't hesitate. Just interrupt me. Raise your hand or comments too, yeah. And if people straggle in, we'll just let them catch up with us. I don't have a handout. We do have this PowerPoint, so you're welcome to take notes however you can. The propaganda on the tables is just to help you get to know who Beth and I are. I'll give you a little bit of background about us and Globe International. So Beth and I have been married for 43 years. This past April, we were married in April on the 17th of 1976 in Goshen, Indiana. So we have four kids, all now grown, married, having babies of their own. I'll show you a picture of them here in a minute about our family. But we traveled, we worked in Asia. We were married in Indiana, got called into missions from our church, went to Asia in 1978. I made my first trip in 77. We made two trips the following year. One, I went alone again with a team, and then the second one, Beth and I and our firstborn spent 3 months in Southeast Asia and came home from that trip and started making serious plans about moving to Asia, and we finally did move to Asia in August of 1979 and spent about 15 years there. Came home in the early 90s. So our work there was evangelistic crusade work, large-scale work. We did that with two different teams as young fledgling ministers, interns, and then we launched our own ministry in 1983, and did that up until the early 90s, working primarily in Thailand and in Sri Lanka. We had most of our fruit in Sri Lanka. We lived in Thailand, but we traveled to Sri Lanka, which is about a 1,500-mile journey, 3-hour flight across the Indian Ocean to Sri Lanka, which is an island nation on the southern tip of India. And we had a lot of fruit there. After about 3 years of hard work, we discovered a harvest field in the mountains among the Tamil people. And I mean, it was like an amazing thing, picking ripe fruit from Hindu people that were hungry for the gospel. And we worked there for a decade, harvesting, planted 36 churches. I wasn't a church planter, I was an evangelist. I didn't have any interest in planting churches, but the Lord dealt with me about it. It's a long story, it's not a subject today, but the Lord dealt with me that I had to do something because there were no churches. We were in areas where there were no churches, and the only way these people were going to grow in their faith was to have a place to go and learn the Bible and fellowship together with common believers. We started planting churches. It was an amazing time. Now we planted 36. The group itself continued to multiply. Today, there's almost 100 churches in that group and over 35,000 congregants, all former Hindus. So quite a impressive thing in one way. My heart, however, beats for the 1 million people in the hill country of Sri Lanka, 1 million Tamil people, they're a minority in the country, who are the bigger picture. So 35,000 seems like a lot until you compare them with 1 million, and you realize we've only begun. The good news about that is I'm now working side by side with a young evangelist who's in his mid-30s, and he is traveling to Sri Lanka regularly, and I have challenged him to believe God to plant another 100 churches in his lifetime of ministry. He's a proclamation evangelist, preaching to the crowds, and so the work is going forward. That's very encouraging to see for me. So that's our background in this type of work that rings the bell of Next Generation Alliance, and that's why we love being related. What we've done since we came home in the early 90s is we moved to Pensacola, Florida, and started working first as the assistant director of this organization. The magazines that are there on your table, it's a missions sending organization, and since 01 when my boss, the director, retired, he asked me to take over, so I've been the director since 01. So what is that, about 18 years, I guess, this year. We moved there in July of 94. So that's our background. If you want to get to know us, please take one of these magazines and help yourself to the pens and zip drives. They're gifts from us to you. But let's get started. So our talk today is Health at Home, Foundations for Ministry Effectiveness and Longevity. Let's see if this thing works. Nope. You want to sit there, Jay, and get it, take care of it for me? So I'll just tell you when to hit the space button. Put you right to work.
That is okay.
Thank you. So this is kind of our workshop description, and I was going to read it from my laptop, but our cord's not long enough, so I'm going to be doing a lot of looking at our thing, at our screen here. But it's easy in today's driven world to neglect our primary relationships while we pursue God-given vision to reach the world. Striking a balance between the call of God and marriage and family commitments is at the heart of following Jesus first. In this workshop, we will explore ways to keep our home life happy and healthy while also being obedient to our call to reach the world for Jesus Christ. Go ahead and advance the slide. So, talking about marriage a little bit, you read that little comic, kind of see the difference between men and women. So, every one of us, how many of in the room are married? Everybody in here married? Have a spouse? I see a lot of single people sitting around, so I'm assuming that you're not here with your spouse. So you can tell your spouses what you've learned today. But he was protesting tougher immigration legislation, and she was protesting a bookstore chain. Say no to borders, and neither told the other the truth, and they lived happily ever after. Well, that probably isn't quite accurate, but we all enter into marriage, into our marriage commitments with certain expectations and certain presuppositions about what this relationship is going to be like. Go ahead and advance the slide. I heard one comedian say one time, he asked the question, why do people put the sign "just married" on their car when they're leaving the wedding reception? It sounds like they're already disappointed. To think about that for a little bit. I remember one pastor said to his congregation, he said, if love is a dream, then marriage is the alarm clock. And all of us who are married probably had some experience with that. Getting to know our spouses from that dating relationship, which sociologists call that dating time limerence. Have you ever heard of the term limerence? It's that time, and this is a biological fact, apparently, that when you're in love, you know, you're in love with someone, and all you can do is think about them, and all you can do is just, that's all you can do is think about them. Your mind is just sort of high on them. And sociologists and biologists, physicians say that the effect of limerence on your brain is similar to the high of cocaine. I wouldn't know. I've never snorted cocaine, but I know what it feels like to be in love. And that's a high, and it's a nice thing, and thank God we all experience these things when we're dating and when we first get married. That person we married is just wonderful, and we can't find any faults in them. But as we live together, then we start seeing things about them that are imperfect, and we're going to deal with that here in just a little bit, what that means. But I want to give a couple of little door prizes away, and I'm going to test a couple pieces of knowledge today. So if you have the answer to this question, do you know what Peter says about a husband's and wife's roles? We all know what Paul says, but how many of you know what Peter says? Any guessers? What does Peter say? He says,
"This is not a joke.
This is in the Bible.
This is the real deal.
This is in 1 Peter.
1 Peter chapter.
Yes, sir. What does he says? Likewise, wives. Now it depends on the translation. So if you come close, you're going
to
win the prize. There you go. She said it. She got it. So you're going to get a book by Tim and Kathy Keller. This is one of our favorite books on marriage. Yay. Okay, what does he say about to husbands? He says, likewise, husbands.
Love your wife as Christ loved the church.
That was Paul.
Paul.
Ah, sorry, bro.
Live with your wives in an understanding.
There you go. That's what he said. I love Peter's words to husbands. He says, likewise, husbands. And he says, likewise, wives, too. But he first says, likewise, husbands, live with your wives in an understanding way. That's the English Standard Version. I think the King James is like, live with your wives according to knowledge. But in an understanding way, I can tell you as a man and as a husband that has been a lifelong challenge for me, to understand my wife, to live with my wife in an understanding way, to really understand her. You know, what is his name? Author Gray, Michael Gray, was it? He wrote a book, Men Are From Mars and Women Are From Venus. He's not a Christian, but he observed something about the way people are wired, a way they think. And men and women think very differently. The other pastor, what was his name, who does a teaching, he talks about women's brains are wired like spaghetti. Michael Gungor, and so women's brains are wired like spaghetti, and men's brains are like a bunch of little boxes. And we pull one box out like a drawer, and we take that one item out of that box, and then we deal with that thing. And then before we can take any other item out of a box, we have to put that one back in its box and close the door, and then get another one out. Whereas women are multitasking all the time. Men are like, I can't do that. I got my boxes, you know, I got one thing in the box to deal with. So we're very different, and learning how to live with each other in an understanding way and really get along together is a big challenge. What does he say? What does Peter say? Here's the third question. What does he say about all of you? He says it in the same chapter. Anybody want to guess? Now it's really complicated Bible knowledge.
Give a clue.
I'll just tell you. This wasn't part of the test, so I don't have any more books to give away. He says, finally, all of you, have unity of mind, sympathy, brotherly love, which is the Greek word is phileo, a tender heart, and a humble mind. If we could just practice those attitudes, unity of mind, so in other words, we're thinking towards oneness rather than separation and division, sympathy, brotherly love, tender heart, and a humble mind. If you think about all the conflicts we might deal with our spouses, it usually comes down to our failure in one of those areas to deal with our spouses in our hearts. Before the behavior ever happens, it's in our hearts where we fail first. So, I want to talk. Let's go ahead and advance the slide. Oh, okay. So, our family, just give you a little introduction who we are. Our kids are, this is a rather old picture. I'll give you an updated one in a second. But our firstborn is, you see my wife and I, then our firstborn is a girl sitting next to my wife and her husband, who's a surgeon, above her. Our second born is the guy far left, come in one with a white shirt, and his wife is sitting below him. He's an attorney with the Air Force. Then the third child is the single guy on the far left in the plaid shirt. He's now married. I'll show you his family in the next picture. And then the fourth, our youngest, is Kelly in the yellow blouse in the center. Her husband is above her in the whitish pinkish t-shirt. And I think we have here, do we have nine of our grandchildren?
Six, seven.
Is it seven only? One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight. So we have 11 now. So go to the next slide. Okay, so this was taken recently. This one was taken just like last month. And the reason Trevor and his wife are up there, because they're in New York and they weren't with us on this one. And you don't know how hard it is to get a picture with everybody when you have a family this size. Anybody has families this size, you get it. It's like trying to get a picture of Sasquatch. I mean, it just never happens. So we had everybody together, and before they were leaving the house, I said, okay, everybody go out and sit in the front porch. We're getting this picture. So we had to do a selfie. That's how impromptu it was. But we have a wonderful group. Two of our grandchildren are now teenagers, so our kids are dealing with those new realities of making decisions. And Trevor and his family are in New York, and he's actually studying at Tim Keller's Reformed Theological Seminary right now, preparing for ministry. So anyway, we're proud of our kids. I joke with them, you know, we got a doctor, a lawyer, an engineer. He's trained as an engineer. Now he's getting a master's degree in biblical studies. And Corey's a PA. She's a physician's assistant. Our youngest daughter is a banker. Mike is all there, the far left, the black T-shirt on the far left. He's runs an auto service store, so our cars get taken care of, our health gets taken care of, our legal problems get taken care of. You know, we got an amazing retirement plan. So, I'm one of those boring guys that likes to pull my pictures out of the wallet and show everybody and bore them to death. But I want you to see this because Beth and I are now. We're at a time in our lives when we are bearing the fruit of the decisions that we made earlier in life to stay married. And I'll get to that in a little bit in this talk, because we went through times when we did not want to stay married. I mean, we were not happy, and we were not enjoying each other at all. So we chose to stay married, and now we're enjoying the fruit of that decision. So let's talk a little bit about foundations before we get into some other things. Go to the next slide. So foundations, we're going to talk a little bit this morning, this afternoon. I'm going to try to keep this rolling, but three things: foundations, functions, and fruits. I'm using some alliterations, not because I'm hooked on that. It just worked really well. There's a foundation in creation. Can you go to the next slide? There's a foundation in creation for marriage and the family. It's built right into the creation, and it's important for us to remember something about the foundation of marriage and creation, and that is the fact that these things were founded before the fall. You know, there was one thing that God said about the created time that was not good. And what was that?
Man would be alone.
It's not good for man to be. Everything else was good. 7 days of creation, God looked at everything. It was good. It was good. It was very good. And then right in the middle of it, he had one guy. You know, there's all these animals and all this life, but there's only one guy. And God said, it's not good. I think that's profound. That it's recorded that way in Scripture, as if to accentuate the fact that God designed us for community. He designed us specifically for the union, the communion of marriage. And the way we are built, it's important to remember this foundation in creation, this biblical, theological foundation that's recorded in the creative story, creation story. God made this thing real for us, that nobody wants to be alone. We are not built to be alone. And here, the disingenuous thing about our culture, especially Western culture, I'll pick on Western culture because having lived in Asia for 15 years, I observed that this is not a feature of many other world cultures. It's more of a feature of Western culture, and that is this hyper-individualism. And we are now conditioned by our Western culture to go it alone, think, you know, we can do it by ourselves. And in reality, much of our culture's pathology grows out of this untruth. And in fact, we are not built to live and go it alone. We are built for communion and community, and that starts in a healthy relationship with one other person and companionship. It was a God-designed feature. And it's important to also remember that it exists, pre-existed creation in the Trinity, and what we know as the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. And it's interesting, even in that metaphor, however we would define that in the English language, it's Father and Son. It has to do with family already, and God even identifying Himself to us. Some of the current trends to redefine marriage in terms of gender definitions and human relationships is still based upon this deep longing for this connection with someone else and companion with someone else. And I think that's a bridge point for us as Christians to recognize, even though some of these expressions are unhealthy and unbiblical, they grow out of a deep longing of human beings to be connected. Some of those features that are good for us to remember is, number one, we're equal in worth and purpose. This is a feature of God's oneness. His God is three, but he's not three. He's so unified in his person, the Godhead, that he's one. And yet there's this equality equality in worth and purpose, which is meant to be expressed and understood in marriage. It's complementary, and that comes out first of all. It's complementary in multiple ways, but it comes out first and most obviously in our physicality. Men and women are different physically, and that component, that feature of godlikeness, is our ability to create. We call it procreation. I'm the dad of four kids, and now the grandfather of 11, and I tell you, the mystery and the miracle of creation in birth has never gotten old for me. And if you are a parent today, you know, we can have the docs, and thank God for medical science, and I don't think science is our enemy. Some of the ways it's skewering sideways and not acknowledging God in its thought is sad, but we're grateful for what we've learned about the human body and about how human beings are created through sexual intercourse and the union of two people. But it is absolutely creative and miraculous that God allows us to participate in the creation of new human beings. That's amazing to me. Now, we know God ultimately formed every single human in his mind and his heart prior to. We know this from Psalm 139. But that's something I think is important for us to remember. I'm laying these foundations because what troubles me as a leader is how much even we as a church are saturated with the influence of culture, and we lose sight of some of these powerful things. And when we lose sight of them, what the end result is, when our marriages go through difficulty, we are less inclined to hold on to these deep principles that bond the world together. So they're also complementary in our interdependent roles, which I believe is a feature of God's triune identity. The Father has a role, the Son had a role, the Holy Spirit has a role, and husbands and wives have roles in our marriages to make our families work. The Christian leadership should be a modeling of this feature. It's God's character. It's revealed in creation in an exemplary way. And one of the things that's I think is disingenuous for us, especially as leaders, And I don't know you. You don't know me. So please, if I say some things here that are a little tough, especially if you've had a divorce in your experience, please hear me with grace, because God is the great forgiver. He's the great healer. But one of the things that I deal with in the people that I influence is folks who are going through some of these difficulties and their marriages fail. Sometimes they make too light of it. Before they allow God to heal them, they make too light of it by saying, well, we're all broken people, and you know, our marriage broke, and we make too light of it, and we forget that the better way is to say we are broken. Beth and I are broken, and we almost didn't make it in our marriage. We almost didn't make it. We considered divorce, and then we decided, you know, for the sake of our children, we wouldn't get divorced. And we also had a very deep sense of it's wrong, we should not do this. And that's what held us in, even during the darkest times when we were not happy with each other. It was so tempting to think of just quit. And one of the things I remember finding out about myself during those times, when it was very tempting to think about, oh, I just want to run and get out of here, you know. And my pastor one time, when I was confiding in him, he said, yeah, it's kind of like jumping out of the frying pan into the fire. And I'm like, I pushed back and say, well, it already sucks in the frying pan, so I don't think it'd get any worse in the fire. Of course, he disagreed with me, but that's where my state of mind was at that time. But one of the things I discovered about myself during that time was, I really love my children. I really love my children. And I didn't want to put them through what would happen to them to see mom and dad break up. That's at the end of the day, that's what held me in place and kept me going. So my point here is to say, yes, we are broken, and sometimes divorce just happens, and it just is impossible to avoid because one party departs. Paul deals with that. But the better way, if we can possibly find our way through those dark times, is to say, I'm going to make my marriage work no matter how hard it is, so that God can be glorified through our union, and that the power of Christ's redemption can be on display for the world to see. And that is what happened to Beth and I. We walked through that difficult time, and there were some consequences. One of our daughters suffered as a result of it. If I have time, I'll get to that story briefly. But now what I see, and I look back and I see after 43 years, and this happened when we were probably in the area of about 15 to 18 years married. We went through several years of difficulty. Now I look back and I say, boy, I'm so thankful for what God allowed me and allowed us to experience, even in the pain and the difficulties, because it really did have an amazing effect on now what we can do and what our testimony does for others to help them to say, you got through and we didn't break.
One of the things, too, in going through a process like that is you know, realizing that as Christians, each one of us is being transformed into the image of Christ, mm-hmm. and that God in his role, assignment as a husband, as a wife, that's our ultimate goal, is to be Christ-like. And through these difficulties, we all know that through the fire is what transforms us. You know, it gets rid of all the crud,
yep.
you know, all the bad attitudes, all the, you know, the bitterness, resentment, pride, and that, you know, along with the commitment to our children,
mm-hmm.
Our commitment to Christ and his refining fires, I think, is
yep.
was very important through our process.
That's great. So the next thing is covenant, another foundation. Tim Keller observes that in the Bible we see, and this is what he says, quote, covenants literally everywhere throughout the book. And there's horizontal covenants in the Bible between people, between two people, between families, between nations, and then there's vertical covenants between God and people, like the one that God made with Abraham in Genesis 12 through 17, reiterated over and over in those chapters. Marriage is unique, according to Keller, and I agree with him on this theological position, that as a covenant, marriage has both a vertical and a horizontal feature. It's before God, it's instituted by God, it was created by God, and it is done before him and also with people as witnesses. Even in our ceremonial procedures in our culture today, in most cultures of the world, it's formalized in this way. Christian cultures, of course, incorporate this idea that married before God. In the first covenant, not the first one, but the Abrahamic covenant, you know, in Genesis 12 through 17, Abram gets a new name, so his family name is changed. There's this promise that to him that involves his marriage and his family. What was the promise? What was the promise to Abraham? Yes. And how was that promise first instigated? It's not a trick question.
One child.
Yeah. So it came through a family line, and it came through a miracle. Abraham and Sarah were barren, unable to have children. And yet Isaac was the promise, the beginning. So again, this major covenant between God and man started with marriage and family. Out of Abraham's own flesh, the Bible says. And the covenant was ratified. This is a good one. I love this about the covenant. The covenant was ratified through a cutting ceremony. In the Hebrew, you know, we kind of lost connection with this, but the Hebrew word for sealing a covenant means to cut. And they took it in chapter 15, I think, it says, here's what God said to Abraham. Bring me a heifer, 3 years old, a female goat, 3 years old, a ram, 3 years old. So we got three basically large animals, a heifer, which is a cow, a female goat, a ram, a male goat, 3 years old, a turtle dove, so something small, and a young pigeon. Five different animals, three big, two small. He brought him all these, and Abraham cut them in half and laid each half over against the other, but he did not cut the birds in half. And then he, you know, chased the birds away, and it seems that like the Lord came down and kind of walked between these pieces. So the covenants were made with animals being cut. And the inference was, in the covenant, was that if I break this covenant, let what happened to these animals happen to me. And in the God's covenant with Abraham, it's like God himself is declaring this above himself. And this became the symbolic covenant that went forward, which became expressed in circumcision, the cutting of the flesh. So what do we do today when we make a covenant, contract? It's not quite a knife, is it? It's ink on paper. You know, we've kind of, and I don't want to disparage our culture, but it doesn't have the impact. You know, it doesn't have the impact. I promise, you know, we sign, I promise to give you everything I own, you know, and love you to death do us part, and I'm promising this with a signature. I think it'd be a little different if there was a knife involved. We talk about shotgun weddings, you know, and maybe that we should go back to having some knives. I remember this movie. How many of you saw the movie The Big Fat Greek Wedding? Okay, so he comes to the house of the family. And at this engagement party, Tula's brother says to Ian, who's the fiance of, is it Tula? Is that how you say her name? He says, he takes him aside, and it's all happy, and they're all there, and food is, you know, it's Italians, and they're all just happy. And he takes him aside and says, I got to tell you, I've never seen my sister's, oh, Greeks, yeah, by big fat Greek wedding, yeah, thank you. he says to Ian, he says, I got to tell you, I've never seen my sister so happy. Pause. If you hurt her, I'll kill you, and I'll make it look like an accident. Pause. And then he smiles and says, hey, geez, look at you. It's just a joke. It's just a joke. And then he gets serious again. He says, I tell you, I got a gun. Yeah, I got a gun, and I swear, I'll look at you. I got you again. I love that because it's sort of the Greek way of saying, don't mess with my sister, you know. Maybe we'd be good to have a couple brothers talking to us men sometimes. When you marry my sister, you better be careful, because if you mistreat her, I'm coming over.
I quote that all the time. I have daughters.
Yeah, you get
it. I do that exact thing with the kids all the time.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm being a little facetious. I want to keep this a little light. I don't want it to get too heavy. But there is something very serious about this that our culture has lost track of and lost sight of. And we as leaders need to re-embrace these things in a very, very deep way. This idea of the covenant. My brother, I'm 64. When I was 29, my brother Dale was 27. He's living in California. We were in Thailand in the mission field. And he killed himself in L.A. He was a part of a church. He was serving the Lord, but he got very depressed. We think it was something more of a chemical imbalance. The tragedy that happened to our family as a result of that, we came home for a few months to grieve, and I remember being very sad and grieving for 2 years. And I also remember this sense of the Lord allowing me to, in a very personal way, experience some of the grief that he feels when people do tragic things. And I also remember down the line being not mad at my brother. I never really went through a lot of anger over it, just really sadness. But I remember thinking, you know, Dale, you killed a whole family line. You know, I'll never know the wife. He didn't have a girlfriend. He had, you know, girlfriends, but no serious relationship. I never met your wife that you'll never marry. I'll never meet your children that you'll never have. This whole family line, he'd be 2 years younger than me now and would have grandkids today. And that's what happens in divorce. We knock off a family line. And again, I want to keep this, I don't want to get it too heavy, because I have no desire to put guilt on anyone if divorce has been a part of your experience. But I think it's important for us to remember there are consequences, And those are all the things that weighed on us as we were pondering. And I think as we lead people, we need to help them. We need to help them understand these consequences and how important it is to be faithful to your spouse and take marriage and family seriously. We're just walking through one in my world with a family that was a part of our ministry for 19 years and chose to not continue after a year of getting counsel. It's tough, and they have three children. It was very, very tough for them and very tough for me to watch the effect. The world kind of teaches us this disingenuous, untruthful thing that says marriage ought to be heaven on earth at all time, and if it's not, there's something wrong and you ought to get out. And I'm like, whoever came up with that idea is just insane. You know, it's not fun all the time. Marriage is work. One cheeky commentator said, marriage is the worst institution ever devised by man, except for all the other ones. You know, the world is broken. You find the perfect girl, or you women, you find the perfect guy, you're going to ruin it when you enter that relationship. You know, that's the thing we have to come to term with. And Paul said in Philippians chapter 2 verse 12, he said, "Work out your salvation with fear and trembling." God has given us the gift of eternal life. We are secure in that. But until that day we go to heaven, we are working out the crud in our lives that poisons our relationships on those days when we're hitting low points, and we work it out. And there's a power in that I think we need to re-embrace in our culture, and that's the power of suffering. I look back on the stuff that Beth and I went through. And we have a great marriage today. We love each other. I'm delighted. I wouldn't want to be married to anybody else. I'm well trained. So we love each other, and we see the fruit of our commitment in our children's lives. And I see the grief I went through when my brother died. We all had these battles in our lives, and now I look back on those things and I say, God, you have helped me experience some of the grief that Jesus goes through when he watches people that he love struggle. You know, and we grow in empathy. Mm-hmm. When we go through difficult times, we can either become bitter and project blame on other people for our difficulties, or we can embrace the pain and walk through it with faith and with nobility, with godly humility. And later, God will use those things to give us empathy to share with others.
Can I interject something?
Yes, please.
Well, when Doug was talking about his brother, I thought, I just wanted to... part of the story is the mercy and the grace, the redemption of God. Is the day we received the phone call from Doug's dad about his brother taking his life. Like Doug said, we were in Thailand. So I went downstairs, went to the kitchen, the refrigerator to get a drink of water, take it to Doug. And at that time, the Lord spoke to me. We had two children at that time. The Lord spoke to me that he was going to give us another child to bring joy and love to our family. And I thought, well, that was kind of a weird, you know, timing of God to do something like that. So I didn't say anything about it. We came home for the funeral and to be in the States for a little while, and I got so sick. I mean, I thought, I've got flu, I've got a nasty cold, something. You know, I was sick, and here, I was pregnant already. I had morning sickness. And so, 9 months from when Doug's brother died, we had our third child.
And exactly, to the day.
And
9 months to the day.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And it was just a provision from God, you know. That mm-hmm. And one of the blessings was that's our son Trevor had this special relationship with Doug's dad. I mean, they were just, it was just, even though we weren't with them very often because we live on the mission field still, there's just a real special bonding there. And that was just, God's way of bringing healing to our family.
Yep. Yeah, thanks for that.
So go on.
Yeah. So, difficulties in marriage reveal who we really are. How many would say that's true? You know, for the longest time when we were going through difficulties, I thought it was all Beth's fault. You know, I was perfect and she was just messed up, you know, and I just, why she couldn't get with the program. I look back and say how arrogant I was, you know, I had no idea. I thought I was humble and I thought I was walking with God and, you know, I really did think my heart was pure. I wasn't doing wrong things, you know, I wasn't looking at porn, I wasn't having drug or alcohol problems, I wasn't doing anything evil. But what I wasn't doing is I wasn't living with my wife in an understanding way. I wasn't attending to her emotional needs. I wasn't getting it. And she was sinking under the burden of 2 children, then 3 children, and then 4 children while I was saving the world. And I wasn't getting it. And that was my big learning. It took us a long time for me to come to terms with my part in that, and it took time for her to come to terms with some of the needs that she had to deal with in her life. So difficulties in marriage reveal who we really are, and the question for us is, are we willing to take an honest look at that? Or do we just want to kind of say, well, it's not my fault, I'm perfect. I see this so often in marriages that don't work. Somebody starts the process by saying, I'm not happy. You know, I'm not happy, and we've got issues, and the other person has got to then decide, am I going to listen to my spouse, or am I going to say, well, it's all your fault, I'm not doing anything wrong, because they're happy, you know. My wife wasn't happy, and I was, and I'm like, well, work on it. Wrong answer, you know. So are we willing to take an honest look at those things and then let the difficulties reveal and do a redemptive work in us? Well, let's go to the next one, canon. We're going to quickly do this because I want to encourage some discussion. So of course the canon of Scripture, it just is replete with the holding up the value of marriage, the community that we see in Genesis, where God said it's not good for man to be alone, but I'll make a helper that is fit or corresponding to him. The complementary aspect of Scripture, the rib is taken out of Adam and used to create the woman, and he said, this at last is bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman because she was taken out of man. The Hebrew words, and I'm not a Hebrew scholar, but I remember one leader said, when the man, you know, who is the man in Hebrew is Ish, and when he saw the woman after he woke from that sleep that he was in, he says, Ish! Ah. So the man is Ish and the woman is Ish. Ah. And men have been doing that about women ever since. And then, of course, the procreation aspect. A man shall leave his father and mother and be hold fast to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. He shall cleave, is the King James. The very powerful word there. In the Hebrew, it has an insinuation of being glued to. Our best English words are cleave, be united to, hold fast to his wife, and should become one flesh. Next slide, it's in the Mosaic Law. I think it's interesting that 3 of the 10 commandments deal with marriage and the family. Honor your father and your mother. There's only 2, it's another little tidbit of 10 commandments. There's only 2 that are positive. All the rest are negative. Remember the Sabbath and keep it holy is positive. And honor your father and your mother is positive. And then 2 other ones have to do directly with the marriage covenant. Do not commit adultery and do not covet your neighbor's wife. 3 of the 10, that's a pretty amazing percentage dealing directly with these commitments. Jesus, of course, we're familiar with what he said. All of his references were going back to Mosaic Law. He constantly was re-bolstering this idea of marriage as based on the laws of God, the character of God. Paul, the picture of Christ in the church, like our brother said, you know, the great Ephesians texts that Paul reiterated. And then of John, of course, the eschatological picture of the end times is this marriage supper of the Lamb. You know, there's a marriage. So marriage is in Genesis and it's in Revelation. It's through the whole Bible. Let's move on to function quickly. So functions, the idea of consideration. Peter said, husbands, live with your wives in an understanding way. And Ephesians 5, I don't know if I have that on your screen here. What does the next one say?
It's 1 Peter
Okay, no, I don't. So let's just, I'll just give this one. Ephesians 5, 22 to 33, so it's 11 verses, emphasizes that wives must consider their husbands and husbands must consider their wives. And the relationships are compared with the one we have with Jesus. Attending to the relationship in the same way as is kind of another way of saying it. Tim Keller, this is something from the book I gave out. This is one of the best books on marriage. I highly recommend it. When you got married, here's what he says. When you got married, you saw the gold in your spouse. But as time goes on, you also see the impurities. You see attitudes and personality traits and sinful habits that are going to be burned off as dross in the light of God's glory over time. These flaws are not permanent, but they can loom large in your mind and create big problems. And that is hard to take. And if the two people learn to make the distinction between the dross and the gold, it can be a great help. And then he goes on to unpack this idea about working together and being cooperative in that process, that God is actually using your spouse to reveal. And so we need to see our spouses not just as a selfish helper for me and my needs and my goals, but they're there as God's purposeful person to reveal better than anybody else in the world. You can hide your stuff from everybody else, but you can't hide it from your spouse. You're living right in the same house. You can't hide it. And we need to see that as a gift that God gave us. Just for time's sake, I want to move on to children. So children, parenting is our highest calling in marriage. One of our missionaries that I coach, he's living in Thailand. He's a young man, but they have four beautiful daughters. And he says, and he's doing CPM, discipleship making church work in the northeast of Thailand. So they're trying to start church planting movements. And he says, my first discipleship assignment is to my children. So he makes a high priority. I remember as a young man, I made this decision. Something became, I don't know if I want to call it a vow, but it became a mantra. It became a principle in my life that I incorporated. And I don't even know where I got this idea. But I decided I will never allow myself to become emotionally separated from my children. In other words, I want to be attentive enough to them, not just be sure that they're obeying me on the outside, but that, are you okay? You know, are you okay? In other words, emotionally. And one of the things that happened in our youngest daughter when Beth and I were going through our difficult time, one of the things we're very careful. We didn't fight or show conflict in front of our children. We tried to protect them from that, but our youngest daughter was not easy to be fooled. She was the youngest. Oddly enough, she was the youngest, but she is the most sanguine of all of our children. So she is the consummate sanguine people person personnel. She works at a bank now, and she's moving up through Navy Federal. They love her because she's such a people person. And even as a little kid, she was observing that mom and dad weren't getting along. And the way she observed it was in her heart. I found this out many years later, but she observed dad's not being nice to mom. I wasn't giving mom those nice warm hugs in the morning like I had before, and I wasn't doing the little, hey, sweetie, how are you, banter and the kiss on the cheek or whatever. I wasn't doing that. We had this little cold kind of, we weren't doing outward angry stuff, but it was just coldness. And our youngest daughter, Kelly, noted that and started getting a chip on her shoulder towards her dad. That dad is not being nice to mom. And that had amazingly detrimental consequences in her life down through the years. She started making wrong choices, and it all went back to that. And God did an amazing thing. I don't have time to tell you the story, but I can guarantee I can jerk some tears out of you if I did. What God did in bringing her around and back for that healing between dad and daughter to take place. It was an amazing thing that happened. And we were kind of bracing ourselves because she was living with her boyfriend and had gotten pregnant and just a chip on her shoulder, and we had a sit down and talked about a couple things related to that, and it was kind of explosive on her side, not on mine, and I just said, look, I love you, I'm just telling you my boundaries. And she's like, I want you to leave, you know, and so I did, and we kind of were bracing ourselves for difficulty, and we went on a trip to Scotland and came back, and while we were gone, they had gotten married, and were so proud of themselves when they got married, and came to our house, and I tell you, I got my daughter back. It's like, she was, you know, this beautiful, voluptuous 19, 20-year-old young lady, and she just, every time we come over or she come over, she's sitting on my lap and hugging me, and I felt like we're making up for about 5 years of angst. I just let her do whatever she wanted. You know, she could sit on my lap as long as you wanted to. It was a little uncomfortable with a 20-year-old pretty girl. But we're kind of a huggy family anyways, but that was like, wow, this is really over the top, you know. But I let her do it, and God did an amazing thing, and years later we talked about it. She said, I was really kind of had an attitude towards you, didn't I, Dad, during those years? And I said, yeah, I said, but here's where my responsibility was. I said, you know, I told her what I just told you. I said, that was me. That was on me. And I said, I have to apologize to you for that. And thank God your mom and I worked through it and love each other today. And we stuck it in there. And she said, well, I'm glad you did, Dad. Now we're close. They live two blocks from us, have three kids. And so I can tell you, God has an amazing way to do stuff you might never expect when we just walk it out with Him. But our children, I think our children and family life, here's now we kind of get into ministry things. Our children and our family life is really our first ministry, and it's the first way in which we live out our faith. You know, we want people to get saved, we want people to find Jesus. We need to be sure that that's happening inside of our families, making it a high priority, that our faith is expanded into the community first, expressed in our families. So the Great Commission, God's call, this careful blending of the constraints of the covenant, which is our covenant with God and with the people that we're in covenantal relationship, and pursuing God's call and commission. So in our remaining time, we have about, it's 25 after, so we have 15 minutes or so. I want us to kind of talk about this a little bit and get some feedback or any of the other subject matter. I've done a long monologue here, so we'd love to hear from you. Any thoughts about this? How you guys have worked out both your own challenges in terms of marriage and family, and how do you make that work inside of the ministry context? Any thoughts? Or questions for us? You can ask a question if you like.
Well, I'll share, and then I have a question as a follow-up to you guys.
Mm-hmm.
My busy seasons are winter and summer for camping, Christian camping, youth camping. And I think for me, the fruit of all this is inviting and having my family come to some of the camp experiences. They don't come to everything, because in New York, we get out of school so late, and I'm going to Pennsylvania such ahead of time. But I think for me, the first week home after being on the road for 9 weeks, home, you know, intermittently, but after those 9 weeks are done, those 10 weeks are done, I'm home and the phone's off. It's not something that is people yeah. want to have access to me, and I'm like, no, it's hidden, it's gone, and I hop in the pool with my kids, and I'm present. I think practicing that presence is so huge, especially mm-hmm. then if we're called away, if we have a trip, or if we have something going on, it makes that time more valuable. Mm-hmm. My question to you guys was, what was the duration of time that your marriage was struggling in terms of the when it seemed that rock bottom moment, I guess?
Yeah. Well, my struggles started, I think, when Kelly was born.
So that was 88.
88, and then we came home in...
91.
So...
And it was a few
80s
more years
till
late 90s.
To 90,
Okay.
Yeah, probably, yeah.
Yeah. You know, it started kind of gradually.
Right, it always.
You know, and was. Yeah, and then it, you know, built up and boom, exploded then. It was about 5 years then when it exploded. Yeah.
What happened for us, like she said, after Kelly was born, our youngest, she started struggling, and there was some chemical things too that Beth was grappling. It wasn't just the marriage dynamics. There were some other things that later she was diagnosed medically, so that doesn't let me off the hook completely.
Right.
But there was a medical issue too.
And there were some exterior stress things.
Yeah. But our team, we were leading a large team. We had 9 families on our team and 16 kids, I think, at its biggest, and working in 2 countries. So I was traveling a lot to Sri Lanka from our base in Thailand. One of our team member leaders, couples that had been with us for most of the time, they came to us when they observed Beth struggling, and they said to me, Doug, you need to take your wife home. And you know, I look back, and I'm not patting myself on the back, but I have been leadership at Globe now 25 years, and I've observed a lot of men who don't listen to good counsel. You know, and they gave me good counsel, and I took it, and I brought my wife home. If I just said, no, work is important, she'll be fine, you know, we probably wouldn't be married today. Because it did take us a while to deal with our relational stuff that was needing attention, and also some medical things at Beth. It just took a while, and we struggled. You know, we did struggle. And my observation is everybody thinks their struggle is the worst. Nobody has it as bad as I do. I mean, that was my belief. I thought, you know, you have no idea how hard this is. You know, when people try to give me advice, I was pretty stubborn. And but I did that right. You know, I listened to counsel. But it did take a while. Any other? Yes, ma'am.
Do you think that struggle had to do with being out of your own culture?
Yes.
I'm sure that contributed a lot to it, yeah.
Because of the people that I've read about, my husband and I have lived in a great time out of the U.S., but people I've read about, the wives often get the impact of spiritual
warfare.
Yeah. However, it is demonstrated.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And
Beth could comment about this. She was taking care of 2 first. We had 2, and then we had a 6-year gap, and Trevor came along, and that was that miracle story we told, you know, after my brother died. And then Kelly, you know, we decided to have her to kind of round out this little funny family. 2 at the top, and then there's a 10-year gap between Corey, our oldest, and Kelly, our youngest. So, with a 6-year hole in the middle, you know, 2 girls at the top, 2 boys in the middle. So we had 2, and during the years that we had 2, we traveled together as a group of 4. Beth loved doing that. She
we did crusade, you know. Yeah, so we were traveling.
We were traveling all over the world.
We had like a year and a half when we didn't have a home. We just were traveling constantly.
It was actually 2.5.
Oh, 2.5. No.
Yeah, it was 2.5 years that we, at one point, at 2.5 years, we had not had a home of our own for 2.5 years with 2 kids. And then we settled again in Asia, and within a year, then I think Trevor came along after Dale's thing, a year and a half about. Anyway, when the 3rd came and then the 4th, it became impossible to travel together. The logistics and the cost was just changing, and the educational challenges. And so Beth was homeschooling and getting worn out, so she was dealing with multiple layers of stress. One was, my husband's not around very much. 2 was, I have a lot of kids, I only have 2 arms. 3 was, the challenge of homeschooling was pushing her academic buttons. You know, she wasn't educated as a teacher, so as the kids went up through the grades, the challenges, this was the day before, there was no internet, you know, there was no, email didn't exist. We got boxes sent to us across the world with school curriculums in them and paper. So there was multiple things. She couldn't study the Thai language because of obligated to the kids and home life, so she was losing connections with the community, you know, not able to communicate. I was studying Thai and getting
well,
the language down.
Well, she was really good at language, and my learning curve was really not very well at at language. So like you said, you know, being overseas was a definite.
So it was multiple layered.
Multiple thing, yeah.
And those stresses, you know, be kind of like you know, framed it in spiritual warfare. I don't diminish that at all. That's the devil's playing ground. You know, when we're tired and we're stressed and we're overwrought, the enemy can really wreak havoc in our lives.
And another thing that started that snowball rolling is we had some good friends, very close couple that we hung out with a lot before we moved overseas. And Doug was actually back in the States at the time, and he called me and he told me, you know, they had just broken up, that he'd been unfaithful and that they'd broken up. And it's, you know, that sort of brought that reality into my personal world, because this was, you know, way back before, you know, that really didn't happen a lot.
Yeah, divorce was far less common. You know? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, and that kind of, you know, was the devil's playground for me at that time.
Yeah, it was a fear I would abandon her. Yeah. So, yeah, good comment, good question. Mm-hmm. Any others?
What sort of boundaries do you guys have for yourselves now? You know, the tolls of marriage, the tolls of ministry and life pulling. What boundaries do you guys have, or staples do you have for yourselves?
Well, years ago we sort of set up this thing where we realized that Doug really couldn't travel more than 2 weeks away from me. I mean, there had been times when it had been, you know, 6 weeks or, you know, more, and it was just, you know, okay, those days are over, 2 weeks. And now he doesn't want to go anywhere without me, you know, and I'm kind of a homebody thing, you know, with all my grandkids, you know, I like to stay there. So we've had to set up, you know, disciplines like date night every week, you know, and that kind of thing as far as boundaries.
Yeah, and we have, you know, we just recognize we need alone time where we're not with people. You know, we don't have to. We've balanced. I'm a little bit more a socialite than she is, so I've learned. I think the big takeaway for us in maturing in our marriage is learning how to really, really listen to each other. I am now, from the perspective of an older man, amazed at how much I was blind to this, and now how much I see in young men a tendency to just diminish the need to just listen to your spouse. Women get this much more intuitively and naturally than men. They're not every woman, but as a general rule, the female temperament and design by God is more nurturing and is more attentive in the areas of relational dynamics. Men tend to be more dense, and I've seen it over and over again. The man just doesn't, he minimizes what his spouse is going through, and he minimizes her need to be heard, and she's appealing to him to be heard, and appealing to him to be heard, and then finally she's angry. And now she's fighting mad and doesn't trust him anymore. And trust gets broken, and loss of respect gets broken, and now you have no intimacy. You know, intimacy is the fruit of something. That's what we learn. Intimacy is not something you create. Intimacy is something that's the fruit of something else. Intimacy is the fruit of things like listening and honoring and serving and attending, and then respect grows, and then intimacy is just the natural fruit. We've seen this in marriage intensives we do. We help create a place where men and women can, husband and wife can tell the truth to each other. And a couple that's not been talking has a hard time telling the truth. And we say, just pick one thing. You probably have 10 guys, you know, but just one. Tell your wife one thing in a nice way that's been bugging you. And wife, you only get one. You only get to talk for 3 minutes. And it's only me messages, no you messages, you know. But you say, this really hurt me when you did this. And the amazing thing, when a husband and wife can sit down and look at each other and just say, you know, when you did this, it really hurt me. But this is what it made me feel like. And you, rather than fighting and get defensive, you just say, oh, well, thank you for sharing that with me. And the other one shares, pray together. It's amazing how intimacy immediately starts happening. Just immediately. It's just like instant fruit that happens when you have that kind of thing. And Beth and I had to learn how to do that. And now we do it, we still mess up every now and then, but we do it very naturally now. We've learned how to do it. And so we keep our intimacy going well now because we learned. Yep. I guess we have a couple more minutes. Any more? We can dismiss. We don't have to linger. But any other comments or questions?
Not really a comment or question. It's kind of a prayer request. We have 7 kids, and we're just launching into ministry. October 5th is our ministry launch. So we have part of that is a move. And so our house is like getting ready to go on the market. So there's some construction stuff going on. And my wife homeschools all the kids. And so there's that kind of like chaos between some construction going on and just trying to figure out where to homeschool and how that's working. And she's really struggling with that. And on top of that, so we have 2 vans, a 15 passenger and an Odyssey. About 3 weeks ago, the transmission started really slipping on the 15 passenger. And last week, my daughter in Pennsylvania, and the timing belt went. And they just said it's not worth fixing.
Oh, yeah.
So now we have no cars. And we used my father-in-law's car, and my son was coming home one day before I left for here, and there's a dirt road, and there was an animal that ran across, and went through the brake and hit the gas and totaled the car. So now both our cars are gone. The car we were borrowing.
Oh my.
And so that was Monday.
Like 3 days ago.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. And it was like Monday night actually. And then so he's fine, and praise God, it's all that matters, you know, but there's still a certain amount of stress that's going on. So she's like super overwhelmed. I left my job, General Dynamics, which is an engineering firm, last October, to pursue this full-time ministry that we're going through. And so, like, you know, our finances are kind of running out. That time period's over. Now we're at the part where we were depending on donors and that kind of thing. So we have the move coming up. The house is under construction. We're trying to get it on the market. She's trying to homeschool. We crashed 3 cars. We have no vehicles and all the kids at home. And she texted me yesterday morning because the shower in the basement was starting to back up. And that, again, that's why I'm a little distracted here. But you know, she was crying in the bathroom earlier this morning, you know, trying to like not do it in front of the kids kind of thing. And she just texted like all, we just spent like a grand on school clothes and, you know, that kind of thing. And that's all, it's a sewer issue. So that's all that stuff is like, she just like, we just lost everything we just spent. She could use some prayer.
Wow, you guys are like a perfect storm, bro.
yeah, and of course, you know, I'm way out here. You know,
you're either way out of God's will or God's preparing something amazing for you because the devil's fighting you hand and foot.
Something, but it's painful.
What are you, Matthew?
Yeah.
Let's just, you guys gather around Matthew. Let me just, go ahead. What's your wife's
name?
Tara.
Tara?
Let's just all pray for Matthew and Tara, can we? Father God, we just, for a moment, Lord, turn our hearts to you. And for on behalf of this family, Lord, these 7 kids, this man Matthew, his wife Tara, Lord, who have in obedience and in faith committed their lives to your service, Lord, and made decisions believing that they're following you in a ministry call. And now they're facing some amazing, really scary battles. And so I just pray, Lord, that you would undertake for them. God, we just agree together in this time that you would just undertake for them. You would come alongside of them, Lord. I pray that you would give Matthew and Tara peace about the pathway they're on. If there's adjustments that you want to make, Lord, that you would give them clarity about that. Lord, provision for them. Either way, Lord, they need your provision to help with these needs right now. And over all of it, Lord, they need your peace. We just ask you to give them the peace of God that passes all understanding, Lord, in the midst of this storm. I pray especially for Tara as she mothers these 7 kids right now, especially while Matthew's gone. And we just hold them up before you, Lord, and ask for your care for this family. In Jesus' name, amen.
Thank you, guys. Appreciate that.
Yeah, you bet, bro. Well, thanks for allowing us to share a little bit of our lives with you. If you have any questions or anything, you're welcome to grab some of our cards. You can call me or my wife in private and reach out to us. But God bless you guys.